Good morning, and thank you for tuning in to Smart Talk with Robin and Al. We're here every Saturday morning from 9 until 10, and you can listen to it on your radio at AM 1030, or you can stream it on KVOI.com. So about a month ago, on September 9th, parents at the Arts Academy of Scottsdale received a letter letting them know that the school would be closing that Friday for good, and parents needed to find another school for their kids. That gave parents 4 days to come up with another school, to get see if there was room for their kids, to get them registered. And this isn't the first time this has happened. Many people across the state feel there needs to be more oversight of charter schools, not just over school closures, but also the enormous debt that some of them are carrying and the profiteering that some charter owners are taking advantage of, and the lack of transparency. Even some charter operators also want more transparency and oversight. Today's guest is Dr. Dave Wells, the research director at the Grand Canyon Institute. The Grand Canyon Institute provides nonpartisan evidence-based research and education to decision makers, policymakers, and the public on policies which affect Arizona's future. So obviously they do a lot of research on education. They are nonpartisan, and they have a number of former legislators on their board representing both sides of the aisle. Two of their board members are former Southern Arizona legislators, George Cunningham and Pete Hirschberger. Dr. Wells has been on the faculty of Arizona State University since 1998. He is one of Arizona's most prominent policy experts and is one of the founders of the Grand Canyon Institute, which you can check out at GrandCanyonInstitute.org, by the way. He's authored research in many areas, but today we're going to focus on his kindergarten through 12th grade research, which has analyzed education funding in Arizona, and he's also developed proposals for improving charter school accountability and transparency. His research has been found in places as ideological diverse as Mother Jones and Fox News, so he's covering all the bases. And Dr. Wells, thank you for taking time out of your Saturday to join us.
Well, thank you. Thank you for that introduction.
So I wanted to start on charter school achievement, which you all have looked into, because we hear different things about charter school achievement. In your research, and some have said that charters are outperforming public schools, and the others have said they're actually the public district schools are outperforming charter schools. So in your research, what have you found?
We think that the aggregate data is misleading. So the best data we've seen out there, because what you want to compare essentially equivalent kinds of students that essentially have the same somewhat socioeconomic backgrounds and so forth. And that's hard to do. There's a pro-charter center in Stanford University as part of the Hoover Institute called the Center for Research on Educational Outcomes, or CREDO. And they are able to get student-level data. And when they've done that, they've often found overall good outcomes for charters across the country. But in Arizona, they haven't. They found in Arizona, charters actually have done somewhat worse, and in some areas much worse, than district schools are. So now their data is a little bit old, meaning it's from like about 8 years ago. So we don't have current data as we'd like in that respect. So what you'll hear though every time is that that on average charter students perform better, but that's misleading because charter students are from higher income families. If there are Hispanic kids in charter schools, it's more likely, again, they're from higher income families or they're less likely to be English language learners. And when you start putting in those factors and with the aggregate data, which is, when you put everybody in one pot, it's hard to actually make proper comparisons. So when they say charter outcomes are better, it's mostly because the socioeconomic status of the children who attend charter schools in Arizona tend to be higher than the children who attend district schools.
So, what they're using is, are they using AZ merits, or what kind of things are they looking at when they're?
So AZ merits, standardized tests are essentially the only way we can measure student performance, which is unfortunate because you know, a test isn't actually everything about a student. So yes, so the currency when we talk about these things are always AZ merit, because the AZ merit's the one thing that all the students are taking at least through eighth grade. And again, it gets a little bit more problematic in high school because it's you're not always taking it every year like you are from third to eighth grade. So that's usually the thing that they're looking at, and then they're looking at the more sophisticated analyses, they'd be looking at the growth of students over time. But again, when you're looking at aggregate things, you're looking at averages as opposed to actual growth.
So you mentioned something earlier about the demographics of the students, but don't standardized tests, doesn't it make it hard? Because there are certain, what we know about standardized tests is income has a huge impact on how well a child will do on standardized test.
Right. So testing doesn't always exactly measure how much a student knows. It measures a little bit about their family background, because if your parents went to college, if you have a lot of books in your house, all those kinds of things in the neighborhood you grow up. In addition, you need to think of all the other stresses that low-income kids are more likely to experience, from having to be evicted and move during the school year and have been in a different school. So all those things show up in standardized tests, and often don't even have to do much with, you know, what's going on in the classroom. So as a consequence, yeah, standardized tests are partly measuring student learning, and they're partly measuring, though, what the socioeconomic background is of the kids who are actually taking the test.
Right. I remember Alfie Cohn, who writes a lot about education, said maybe 12 or 15 years ago, he said, you don't need to give them the standardized tests because you can save a lot of money. Just tell me how much the parents are making, and I'll tell you what their test scores are going to be.
Yeah. Alfie Cohn is a very good, provocative writer.
Yes. So how do charters stack up in reflecting what our student population then is? Does the... There's 20% of kids in charter schools out of the Arizona K-12 population, and 80% of students who are attending public schools. Do the demographics match those numbers?
Yes, we have the highest percentage of kids in charter schools of any state in the country. So, but in general, the kids who go to charter schools are a bit more likely to be white, and again, they're more likely, and in some cases, like BASIS, for instance, to the degree that they have ethnic diversity, it's primarily because the students are Asian American as opposed to Hispanic or African American. But generally, they're higher incomes. And the other thing you know about charters is you have to be able to get your kid to a charter. There are very few charter schools that actually offer transportation as part of it. So you have to actually be able to get your kid there. So now, again, that creates that income bias, because the parent has to have reliable transportation in order to get their child to a charter school. So even if you do see ethnic diversity, again, it's more likely that you're seeing ethnic diversity from families that are above the poverty line as opposed to families that are below it.
So what does the research show about classroom spending? When charters were first brought to the attention of the Arizona people, when the legislature was trying to pass this, they said that that districts were top heavy with administration, and that if we had charter schools, they would be more nimble, could do more creative things, and that there would be more money spent on classroom.
Yeah, that hasn't transpired. One of the things that I've been trying to figure out, so if you look at actual administrative spending, you'll find that charter schools spend about twice as much per pupil on administrative spending. So district schools vary, because there should be economies of scale. So if your district is bigger, your amount of spending on that should be smaller. And you do see that with district schools. So you'll see a range, and it does vary quite a bit from districts. But on the low end, you'll generally see some of the larger districts have about $800 per student. And this is both school and central administration combined. And as you get larger, some smaller districts, you might move into the $1,200, even the $400 per student range. Charters average $1,600 per student, and it doesn't seem to be relevant to how big the organization is. So we just visited a charter school. There are some very good charter schools, and we just visited one up in Colorado City. And one of the things I looked up when I was there was, what's their administrative costs? And this is, they have two buildings, a elementary school building, and they have a junior high building. So they're going from K to ninth grade. And altogether, I think they have in the range of about 600 some students in the two buildings. And the buildings are pretty close together, so you can walk from one to the other. And their administrative costs are about $1,200 per student. And this is, they're quite frugal about how they go about things. We've looked at other ones, you know, and their administrative costs are $1,600 to $2,000 per student, and they're way bigger. That shouldn't be the case. So that's one of the things we're trying to figure out is what's driving those things, to the degree that they're driven by legitimate things as opposed to simply people being able to set their own salaries and setting salaries that are excessive. Because we do know that that's happening out there. There's a charter up here in the Phoenix area that was paying their top two administrators a combined about $500,000 a year, who were charter owners. Even though they only had about 300 kids in the school. So that does happen. But we're trying to figure out if there's anything else that's going on in the charter sector that drives up their administrative costs so much.
I'd like to talk to you more about this. We're going to take a quick break. And I wanted to talk to you about what exactly administrative costs encompass. So we are talking to Dave Wells. He's the research director of the Grand Canyon Institute, and we will be right back. Hi, we're back. You're listening to Smart Talk with Robin and Al. And today we are talking with Dr. David Wells. Dave Wells, who is at the Grand Canyon Institute. He's the head of the, he's the research director up there, as well as being a professor at ASU. So thank you again for joining us. And thank you, Dave, for coming or for being here with us and calling in. So we were talking about the cost of administrative overhead. So what does that cover? You know, there's a wide variety of prices. And one of the things you said is that in many charter schools, it exceeds what it is in public district schools, possibly because of the scale. But what does it cover?
So generally that covers essentially like somebody be a principal or associate principal, or, you know, or some, whoever's overseeing the administrative part of it. You may have a somebody who oversees the special education portion of a school, and also might be writing out grants or trying to get other kinds of like Title I funding. And you may have people who are overseeing technology things, but generally, what these people aren't doing is they're not teaching, but they're doing helping, you know, administer and supervise and do things to help make the school run. It doesn't include people like custodians and things like that. That's usually put in the school operations, but not in the administration part of it. And also, if you've got a secretary or something like that at the front desk, and those folks would also fit in the administrative category.
So two of the things strike me in this list. One is special ed and Title I funding, because what some of the research has said is that that there isn't a lot of Title I funding that in charters, and that charters also don't have a lot of kids with special education requirements.
That's right. So if you look at where special education kids are located, twice the percentage of kids in special ed are in district schools as opposed to charters. So charters have a much smaller charter population of kids with special ed. And although we haven't fully dug into it, what we have found so far generally indicates that most of the kids who are in special ed in charters are lower needs. Obviously, there's a huge spectrum that's covered by special education or IEPs. And so generally that their needs are usually lower on the scale on average, and a smaller portion of them. And that's also relevant because the special education formula hasn't been revised in a long time. And right now there's some efforts to do that, and we're trying to do some research about that. Because what happens for most district schools is that they actually lose money on the special education formula, so they have to pull resources from their broader funds to help make ends meet on the special ed side. That's probably not the case for most charter schools. In fact, some of them will actually, they should more than cover themselves, because they're, all the schools get a little bit of an extra weight to cover some special needs. And if you have really low special needs populations, like a school-like basis, you actually will end up getting a little bit more resources overall, since you won't have to pull those resources to pay for your special ed needs.
So it seems like there's several things going on there. One is that we're kind of a low, our per pupil spending is lower than most other states. We're often ranked at the bottom. And then there's the federal contribution, which is when the law, the IDEA, was passed, which funds special education. The federal government was supposed to kick in 40%, and they've never kicked in more than 17%. And so the states, which were supposed to pay 60%, are often paying, you know, 67%, 77%. So if you combine that with us being a very low in low per pupil spending, I can see why they have to dig into the other money, because there just is not enough to fund special education, which we are required to do and which we should be doing.
Yeah, that's a fundamental challenge and problem. And there's, every student has these weights that go on it. So, you know, so special ed weights can vary quite a bit. And some of them are just off, because like kids on the autism spectrum currently in Arizona are actually funded all the same, regardless of where you are on the spectrum. So that, and then there are other kids who have special needs that aren't even getting formula funding, so the district's got to pull things from them. So, yeah, so there's a lot of issues. And then on top of that, of course, when we talk about weights, it's weights based off of the base funding. And since the base funding is inadequate, that's the problem that you've got that sort of gets amplified in special needs cases. So, yeah, we have to get more resources into our K-12 system so that we can better serve students. And I think special ed in some respects sort of amplifies that inadequacy, because those kids have, you know, fundamental needs. If you don't meet them, it's not always easy to measure how much they're learning, but you have to supervise them. I mean, they can't just be left to roam around and, you know, do stuff depending on where they are on their on the scale of the assistance that they need.
So is there a range of, you know, the smallest amount you would get for a kid who has special needs to the largest?
Yeah, I don't have the formula thing in front of me, but it can, the way there are weights, so some special needs kids are equivalent to six other kids. So you can get, a significant amount of money. But for many, you know, special needs kids, it actually, if you've got to pay for a person to accompany the kid all the time, on top of whatever other kinds of evaluation techniques you need to do and all the other kinds of interventions you might need, and a lot of them have medical needs on top of all that, that you're talking about a kid who needs to invest $20,000+ in a year just to make sure that they can be somewhat successful in school. And whereas our base funding for a lot of the other students, and they have all these different multipliers and so forth, but, you know, it sort of starts in around the $4,000 or $5,000 range. I mean, I think our average spending per student is higher, but that's mostly because you have to average in the special needs kids, and you add in transportation and food and other kinds of things sometimes on top of that.
What do you know what the percentage is, since districts are now having to take money out of the general education funding for students? Do you know how much a gap there is between what districts are paying and what they're actually being reimbursed for?
We don't know it universally. Sylvia Allen, we're Republican lawmakers, who's chair of the Senate Education Committee, has convened a group that is talking about special education formula issues. And in that group, there is a person from the Mesa School District. So Mesa I think is our the second largest, if not the largest, school district in the state. Anyway, Mesa estimates that they lose about $20 million a year on special ed. So relative to what they have to spend compared to the funding part of it. They have a pretty large budget to start with. So it's not a huge budget, but it's a significant amount of money for them to have to reallocate. And that's taking into account, they indicated, and taking into account the federal money that they get and so forth. So the formula is pretty significantly off for those districts that have a significant number of special education kids.
So I have a question about online charter schools. We were just talking about how our pupil spending is lower, Arizona's pupil spending is lower than a lot of states. But last October, the owner of Primavera Online School, his name's Daniel Kramer, paid himself $8.8 million despite having Arizona's third highest dropout rate. How does that work?
So the online schools, if you ever look at the enrollment numbers for schools, you'll see some weird schools in there where they have like very few freshmen or sophomores, and suddenly they have a ton of juniors and seniors. I mean, like, going from like 100 to thousands. And Primavera is one of them. So essentially these schools are really specialized in the credit recovery business. So students have to get a certain amount of credits in order to graduate from high school. And despite the presence of these credit recovery businesses, our high school graduation rate hasn't really been changing. It's still below 80%. It's been like that for 10, 15 years. I mean, we've had maybe little improvements, but not big changes.
Can you explain what credit recovery system
is? Sure. So if you want to graduate from high school, you have to accumulate a certain number of credits, and they have to be in certain areas. So I think you need to have like four science credits, 4 years of science, 4 years of math, and of English, and so forth. And what happens sometimes is students don't pass their classes sometimes. I had a son who didn't pass all his classes, they want them to graduate on time. So then the idea is that then you're going to take these online classes. And sometimes districts do this, like Mesa has an online program they run much cheaper than Primavera's online program. It's not as big as Primavera, but theirs costs less than $1 million a year to operate. And Damian Kramer is just making millions on tops of millions for his. So students get in these things and you take classes like at Primavera. Your classes are essentially a third of a semester long.
Uh-huh.
So they're compressed times. So if you're going there full time, if you were taking six classes normally at Primavera, you would take two classes for a third of a semester.
Right.
And you do that three times, and that's how you take your six classes. But the question is, do the students really learn anything during that process? And the work from Credo seems to suggest that they don't. The evidence that they found was that there was minimal to no learning occurring in most online environments nationwide and including in Arizona. On the one hand, we have real questions about how much good is happening on that, because you can't just stick a kid in front of a computer and expect the kid's going to fix the things that they couldn't do in a classroom. Mm-hmm. And there's not a lot of evidence that Primavera where a lot of the other online providers provide extra help in a way that would seem to be meaningful. But at the same time, they get almost the same funding as all the charter operators that actually have a school facility that they have to pay for. As a consequence, it seems that they're not providing enough services for students, but they're getting almost the same amount of money as the ones that actually have to pay for having school facilities and all the expenses associated with that. And I think that's what basically enables them to pocket millions of dollars, which is horrible to think.
Well,
that
what was surprising is he paid himself $8.8 million, and then several weeks later, the charter board gave him another charter school. I mean, I would, as an outsider, I read that in the newspaper and thought, $8.8 million. That's a lot for a school superintendent, principal, or however he defines himself.
Yeah, and he does business with himself too. On top of it, so all the Primavera schools contract with his company because you don't have to do competitive bids in a charter environment. So all of his charter companies do business with his charter, I think, and they have a contract about how much they're going to pay Damian Creamer's business for it, and it's based on per student and all these other different things in the formula that goes there. So there's tons of money that essentially goes from Primavera back into Damian Creamer's business, which is a for-profit Damian business, so you don't actually get to see all the ways in which money is made there. I have talked to somebody who worked for that company, and she indicated that the employees were not necessarily, they were paid okay, but not really that well. So, and she was glad to get away from there. So that's sort of a very awful thing. So in the context of Primavera, you've got related party transactions, encompassing 90%+ of the actual expenses of the school, meaning Damian Creamer, he owns both ends of the business. That's, a recipe for kinds of potential corruption without adequate oversight.
So did you just say that 90% of what comes into Primavera goes to Damian Creamer because of he contracts with himself for a bunch of things and...
Right, so he's got
connections. Did I hear that?
So those related, we've got a few charters, and I think Primavera is one of them, where essentially 90% of the dollars go to a related party, and in his case, it's one that he's connected to. And that's legal in Arizona right now, and there's not enough, there's not adequate oversight of what happens within those for-profit companies to, determine whether or not those monies are appropriately expended or not appropriately expended.
We're going to have to take a break, and we'll be right back. If you have a question, by the way, or a comment, you can call at 520-790-2040. And I'd like to talk to you more about for-profits when we get back. And you're listening to Smart Talk with Robin and Al. We'll be back in just a second. We're speaking with Professor David Wells. Thanks. Hi, we're back. You are listening to Smart Talk with Robin Hiller. I'm with Robin and Al. I am the Robin part of that. And we are speaking with the research director from the Grand Canyon Institute, Dave Wells. And we were just talking about oversight and for-profit charters. So thank you, Dave, for coming in. And I'm really learning a lot about this. So one of the things you said is that, or several things you said, is that that there has been, we were talking about Daniel Creamer's Primavera online school, and it has the third highest dropout rate in the country and in the state. And last October, he paid himself $8.8 million. But one of the other things you said that might have gotten lost is that what research has shown is that there is minimal to no learning in online classes.
Right. So the online education is sort of a new area that's sort of been developing a lot, and it's convenient for these credit recovery schools because you can potentially do these from home and so forth. So Credo, which is again is a pro charter institute within the context of Stanford University, they were evaluating student performance. And when they did that and they focused in on the online sector in particular, they found, really horrible results in terms of the context of whether students were learning. Now, they weren't able to, in Arizona at the time, they were looking at four online charters, of which I think they indicated that three were particularly atrocious. But because of the nature of their data, they have to keep everything anonymous related to protecting student information. So they never say which schools are, doing okay and which ones are not. So we don't have that information, but they indicate there are very alarming factors related to online that students simply were not indicating any any growth as a consequence of being in online environment. And so that means that we have a lot of, you know, inadequate instruction happening in the online environment. And we don't really have the tools to evaluate that well. I mean, there are lots of different kinds of students. There's a student who's been struggling in a conventional school and moves to an online one. You know, it's hard to know what the appropriate benchmarks are to try to figure out whether those students are doing well. But that's one of those areas that I think the state needs to do a much better job of trying to figure out how to supervise these schools. Because otherwise, again, the owners of these schools seem to be making tons of money. And it's not just the Primavera. GAR is another one up here, and it's student choice. There's just a lot of them. So it's, in general, most of the online ones have raised a lot of questions for us, and we want to explore that more carefully to try to see if there's ways we can hone in and improve what's going on there and sort of not be rewarding folks for lack of educational outcomes.
So last legislative session, there were a number of bills and a movement in the legislature to create more oversight for charters. And what was the impact of that?
So last year was the first time we sort of got into the meat grinder of actually the legislation part of it, and we were meeting with the folks before the session. But the bill itself, the initial bill that Kate Brophy McGee sponsored, was written by the Charter Association, and so we were spending most of the session trying to strengthen the bill, and so we'd get like an amendment added here or there, so we were gradually making progress in that direction, but hadn't quite sealed the deal. And then the bill got killed by Speaker Bowers, who, I'm not quite sure what it was. But I mean, the challenge that's currently going on with the legislation is that the Democrats don't want to have something pass that Republicans can run on, but at the same time have a bill that's essentially the paper tiger, doesn't really do very much. And so the Democrats really want to have a high standard for that, and arguably sometimes too high of a standard for that. And then on the Republican side, a lot of them don't like regulation at all. That was the whole idea behind charters. They were supposed to be free to do their own thing. They have the idea that somebody can make millions of dollars. The idea if that's, you know, a successful business model, then they ought to be able to be rewarded for it. So they have
to get. But what if it's unsuccessful? I mean, don't they want it to be? don't they want, you know, great oversight in spending and to make sure our dollars are being spent well? Wouldn't that be part of the...
You would hope so. And certainly if it involved people on Medicaid or food stamps or something like that, then you often will hear Republicans talk about how they're, you know, concerned about how people are misspending their money or they shouldn't be receiving it. But they don't. That hasn't translated yet to the charter environment. Again, what we're trying to get with the charter environment is we think the Medicaid model might be a good comparison, because in Medicaid, with access in Arizona, for instance, you have public dollars that fund private provision of services, because that's what a charter school is. It's technically a public school, but it's privately owned and operated. And that's essentially what you get with Medicaid providers in the state, is that they're receiving public dollars, but it's privately owned and operated. And so one of the things that's in requirements for Medicaid that's not in our requirements for charter schools is that the subcontractors in a Medicaid contract are subject to audit from the federal government. So that means, like, when Damien Creamer decides he's going to contract with his own business, that's currently not really subject to audit. There's nothing that really guarantees that our attorney general or auditor general can actually go in and check those transactions and see whether or not anything of concern is happening.
District schools, which are also publicly funded, aren't they required to get three bids on everything practically?
It's above a certain threshold. I think it depends on how much the money is. I think with district schools, if it's below $10,000, there's a lot of discretion. $10,000 to $50,000, there's some things they have to do. But above $50,000, in general, they have to have the competitive bid process. And charters, have concerns about having to get into paperwork and stuff like that. We just like to have them prove that they paid a fair market value for whatever they did. If we don't do competitive bids, which are a little bit hard in some cases with charters, because you've got, like with Basis, you have Basis Ed and Basis Inc. And so they contract out their management operations
to themselves.
A related party. Yeah, to themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And that's part of their whole business, right? And that's, Great Hearts does the same thing up here. So that the two entities are actually essentially connected. So they really can't contract that out because the two companies are essentially one of the same. But what we like to do, have them is prove what they're getting from that company is actually a fair market value. And not just somebody have a line in their audit that said their auditor looked at it and they thought it was okay. We'd like to see that more quantitatively demonstrated. So I think there are some degrees that we're not going to be able to have the same kind of practices at a charter school as a district school, but we should be able to show. And the U.S. government, this is under before Betsy DeVos, but the Department of Education had concerns about things like Title I money going to charters because they weren't really sure that you could follow the dollars enough to actually know that the money was being spent in the way that the federal government expected it to be spent. And so that's what we'd like to see is a greater transparency that simply says, we're paying higher administrative costs to this outside entity, but some explanation that clearly details why their administrative costs are higher than that would justify it and be much, much clearer than what we have now, which is really not clear at all. So that's sort of the compromise that we'd like to at least see them explain that. And then we'd like to have the ability to have audits so that when they do contract out services, that they, if there are questions raised, because we had the one school up here that, got into problems, which I think in turn a few of them have gotten into trouble with the owner was in bankruptcy proceedings with Starshine up here. And because she was in bankruptcy proceedings, she was under the U.S. Department of Justice oversight. And through that oversight, they found out that she was actually spending money on her Hawaiian vacations and doing other kinds of things that you're not supposed to do. And then they reported it to the charter board, and the charter board then shut her down. But the charter board on its own would never have known that because they don't look at the expenses at that level. But we want to give them more power, and they're getting more staff, so that will give them more capabilities to look into expenses where they have concerns, where school doesn't seem to be performing and doesn't seem to be spending too much money in areas that raise questions.
Do you think it's possible? There are a number of charter owners within the legislature and who have made millions, and also owners of school tuition organizations. Do you think it's kind of this, not club, but do you think other legislators are embarrassed to bring it up because these are their peers, and they don't want to cause problems with saying, oh my God, you are kind of doing sleazy things over there?
I don't know because I don't know if to what degree they think some of the things are sleazy. I mean, the folks who are doing the most questionable things don't seem to be in the legislature. I mean, Eddie Farnsworth, who's not running for re-election, so we're actually going to, so he won't be in the legislature after 2020. But he's the owner of Ben Franklin Schools. He's the sole proprietor of it, and he never got federal money for a long time. He ran the schools as a for-profit operation and so forth. And now he's converted them to nonprofit status, but they're going to contract with him. In the process of it, he resold the schools. He made people debate different things, but he made at least $10 million or so on the way in which it was refinanced. So that raised a lot of questions. I mean, a lot of people are sort of concerned about the way in which that came out. In fact, if that information had come out before his Republican primary, there's a good chance he might have actually lost his seat. So I think voters actually are a little bit concerned about these kinds of things. It's why all the politicians on both the Democratic and Republican side were running on charter school accountability and transparency for the first time ever in Arizona this last election cycle. So I think we're moving in a good direction with that. I just think it's just taking a lot of time, and I don't think Republicans are as eager to see change as other folks are.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break right now, and there's two questions I have for you when we get back, one having to do with who oversees the charter system, and we are speaking with Dave Wells. He's the research director at the Grand Canyon Institute. We'll be right back. Thanks. Hi, we're back. You're listening to Smart Talk on KVOI, and we are speaking with Dave Wells, who is the research director at Grand Canyon Institute, which is a nonpartisan think tank. And one of the things they look at is school funding and accountability in schools. But one of the things they looked at earlier this year was how to reduce gun violence and what kinds of policies we could put in place that would help do that. So, Dave, can you talk a little bit about this, what you guys found?
Sure, yeah. We were compiling other studies. It's not an area we usually study, but after that horrific weekend where there was the shootings in El Paso and Dayton within 24 hours of each other, we thought it was a pertinent time to sort of bring some of the research together, because there actually are things that we could do that would be pretty effective. So like in the background check area, background checks certainly help, but what the most within that context of background checks, because right now there's the gun show loophole or private sale loophole, which essentially if you're not getting it from a licensed gun dealer, you're not subject to a background check. And if the background check isn't finished fast enough, then you'll still get your gun. In Connecticut, they have a thing called permit to purchase, which is the most effective version of the background check. It's been thought to have reduced gun-related homicides somewhere between 14% and 40%. And they've had this in place for over 20 years. It's obviously not perfect because it did not prevent the Sandy Hook massacre. That's largely because the mom bought the guns. But the way permit to purchase works is you have to go to your local police department to and you get a background check and to get your permit so you can buy guns. But that fact that you actually have to go to your local police department to do that is incredibly effective in terms of helping to prevent guns sales to folks who would be a danger actually to have guns. So that's one of the most impactful things. Another thing that's quite impactful is currently, if you have, it's not always enforced very well, but there, if you have a felony, violent felony, you're not supposed to be able to purchase a gun. But if you extend that to also people who have done violent misdemeanors, such as an assault that was a misdemeanor, that's also, those people are also at particular risk that if they get a firearm, that they'll eventually use that in a way that either harms themselves or others. You have to keep in mind that 2/3 of our deaths by firearms are suicides in the U.S., which relates also to another policy that we could do. You'll hear a lot about the red flag laws and so forth. And I think the red flag laws, I think part of what they've done, and this came out a little bit in terms of what we saw after we put out the information, is that a lot of the people who actually commit these mass murders are themselves suicidal. And so rather than necessarily focusing on the mental illness part of it, if you focus it especially on the people who have on a suicide prevention aspect of it, and trying to prevent firearms from going into the hands or taking away people's firearms when it appears that they are a danger to them, to themselves or others, and then that's a key way in which you might reduce the likelihood of some of these both reduce suicides, but as well as reduce some of the likelihood of the mass murders that take place. And then the final thing, yeah, go ahead.
We have a caller. And sure. So we wanted to take her call. Melinda?
Hi.
Hi.
I would like, with regard to the schools, the charter schools versus public schools, since you're a think tank, I'd like to know what the outcomes are for the charter school graduates versus the public school graduates. And then on the gun laws, a red flag is something that needs to be litigated. Someone can make an accusation against you. They can say, oh, Melinda's crazy. You should take her guns. And then a court-appointed psychologist could be appointed to your case, to my case, and they could say, oh, she voted for Trump. She's crazy. Take her guns away. We need juries to decide this. You need rigorous due process before something like that would happen, before someone would have their guns taken away. So those are my 2 cents. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Melinda. So on the outcomes of graduates, we don't do a good job of checking that. So we don't have, and of course, outcomes are also going to relate to socioeconomic status. So so if you come from a more prosperous or well-off family, your probability that you're going to go on to college and graduate from college is higher. But we haven't done, I haven't seen any data indicating charter schools versus district schools. I mean, the ideal study would be one where you're looking at essentially similar populations where some have gone to charters and some have gone to district schools and to see how that's made a difference or not made a difference. And so that's, anyways, that's still open. On the red flag laws, in terms of the research there, the research that we found was were studies in Indiana and Connecticut, which are pretty different states. One's a red state, one's a blue state. And what they showed is a decrease in the suicide rate by about 10%. I mean, I don't think jury trials are practical. I mean, but I do think the idea is that we haven't, dived in to figure out what exactly the process was involved with it. But of course, in Tucson that Jared Loftner, when he committed his murders, was schizophrenic, but had not been really properly diagnosed. But we also didn't have a very good protocol, I think, at that time to try to take somebody like that and make sure that somebody like that didn't have access to firearms. So, because that would be an example of the kind of person you would not want to have access to firearms, and you just need to have an appropriate, fair process, obviously. And these are usually temporary. These aren't always permanent things. So that is you're removing the guns from a while until the person has reached a level of stability. Now, you would need to have a psychological professional as part of that determination process, and you need to have appropriate due process rights in order to do that. But in Indiana, it certainly is no area that you generally would think of as a state that's anti-gun. So I'd encourage Melinda, if you take a look at what Indiana does in terms of their red flag laws, to see if you like their process.
And would red flag laws have, you're saying that would have had an impact on the Gabby Gifford shooting, on Jared Loftner not having access to guns?
Well, it was certainly an issue that came up, because the issue was there were certainly warning signs related to his schizophrenia, but there was no data. And then data wasn't being, databases are only as good as you put data into them. So we didn't have databases that were linked very well with the mental illness part of it. So he's the kind of person who could have potentially been prevented from getting it, because I think he got his gun at a Walmart. And I think that, he could have potentially been stopped at some point if we had an adequate either, obviously like a permit to purchase system would probably have been, could have been quite effective in his case, because he would have had to go into a local police department and they would maybe been able to observe directly that he may have some issues. And then again, if some of these other records related to his attempt, I think, to get in the military and stuff had somehow gotten into a database, then I think, there's a greater chance, and again, no system is going to be perfect, that that he could have been prevented from getting a firearm.
Right, because his school told him he had to leave until he'd gotten help. Also, the first Walmart he went to said no, and then they wouldn't sell him a gun, and then he went to another one. So this is, we have about 1 minute left, and I want to thank you for coming on, and also ask you a quick question. Why is our charter system not under the Arizona Department of Ed? When we have such a small budget here, why are we creating a second system of education? Can you answer that in 41 seconds?
I think that's a great question, because I think the charter board would be better served if it was under the Department of Ed. And I think the charter board would be better served if it had a greater diversity of people on it. Most of the people on the charter board, again, a lot of them do a very good job, but almost all of them represent the charter industry itself. And we don't have enough independent voices on that board.
Okay, I want to thank you for coming on. That was Dave Wells from the Grand Canyon Institute. You can check their research out at grandcanyoninstitute.org. Thanks for joining us. Bye-bye.